from the creators who brought you RuPaul's Drag Race and Million Dollar Listing. This is World of Wonder's Wow Report. Things that make us go wow.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Wow Report, where we count down the top 10 topics of the week that make us go wow. I'm Fenton Bailey, co-founder of World of Wonder, joined by our Chief Creative Officer, Tom Campbell, best-selling author and host of the WOW podcast, Night Fever James St. James.
Hello.
And a very special guest, our former WOW Report contributor, Trey Spiegel.
Hello.
And of course, Blake is there somewhere.
Right. This, if you're watching this on YouTube, it's kind of Blake and the bald guys wearing glasses. Like, that should be our rock group. Blake, come on screen. Come on. Yeah.
With a collective age of about 1,000 years.
It's nice. The looks are very locked this week. I feel like the background singers to Robert Palmer. And right. You
know, I love
it. If you had only worn black, Fenton, we would have been able to coordinate this.
Right. Look. I'm going to change right after the first commercial break. Number 10.
Number 10.
So yesterday morning, I woke up to some news. I was, as we all did, when I went on to Twitter, and I call it Twitter. I don't call it X. I refuse to. There was on my timeline, it was all RIP Ron Goldman, RIP Nicole Brownson, RIP over and over again. I kept thinking, well, why is that? Why is that? Well, it turns out that O.J. Simpson had died the night before. Colon cancer. What was it? Did anyone?
Cancer. He's 76. That's all I know.
And weirdly, NPR had two very strange headlines about it. I will read them to you. The first one was, O.J. Simpson, football legend, acquitted of notorious killings, dies at 76. And the other one, so first of all, O.J. Simpson, football legend is how they call it, was what they call him. And the other one was, breaking news, football great Orenthal James Simpson, known as O.J., has died. So they sort of buried the lead or sort of... Yeah, NPR is very right-wing leaning these days. It's very strange.
Left-leaning, you mean?
No, they're right-leaning. They are very pro-OJ. Yes. Oh, you guys are not paying attention to this. All they are lately is they're very pro-Trump. They're very
there
weird.
There was an article I read about some guy who's worked there forever complaining about how it's gone off the rails, but I didn't.
Thank you. You guys are looking at me like I'm absolutely bananas. You don't know anything about this?
Nope.
Not really.
Enlighten us. That's why we're here.
You're the one who just backed me up, Fenton. You're the one who says that
I know. I didn't read the article because NPR is possibly one of the most boring media outlets around, right?
It's what wakes me up in the morning.
Well, okay, Trumper. Maybe you should get with the times.
I thought the article, next time I'll read it before I discuss it, but I thought the article was that it was too liberal. That it had become opinion that it was too woke, and that was the problem with NPR. I thought that was a criticism before this whole OJ thing.
I'm guilty of just reading the headlines as usual, and then jumping on Facebook to make some pronouncements. So,
and I'm wondering if lauding OJ for his accomplishments is not erasing a black achievement in the history of times. And I would say that we wouldn't be interested in the OJ death trial if there hadn't been OJ. The football star celebrity. So he is both of those things, all of those things.
But really more famous in the end for being an acquitted murderer.
The last 30 years, I mean, yes, I would say that his accomplishments.
And going to jail and being caught up in scandal.
I don't take any of that away. It's horrible. I'm just saying that the whole package is what made it such a historic moment.
And then the stealing of his memorabilia. Remember that too.
Yeah.
That was fun. It was no Naked Gun part 1, 2, and 3.
Well, it's, you know, it's funny. It's kind of like a Bill Cosby thing where someone is so loved and respected. And so many comedians, you know, Jerry Seinfeld goes on and on about how much he loved Bill Cosby. And then, you know, it doesn't matter what you do. It's how you end up, I think. It's
true. It's very true. Yes.
Sort of weird. Talk about go off the rails.
Well, what about Michael Ehrlich, James? I mean, that's how he's always going to be remembered.
Well, talking about an article that you didn't read, but you just saw and you didn't even look at the, you know.
Yeah, no, guilty as charged. All the above. Absolutely.
Bring it.
Yeah, I'm here for it.
I think we're done with this segment. I think we can move on.
All right. Well, then, okay, I'm going to move on.
And just as we say number nine, Trey wanders off.
I realized I didn't have my other light on. Now I have another light.
James has got to adjust his light. All right, let's go on to number nine.
Number nine.
R.I.P. Patty Astor. So downtown New York and lots of folks in L.A. are in mourning this week. The glamorous, fantastic Patty Astor passed away 2 days ago. Those of you who don't know her name specifically, you probably know some of her accomplishments. She was an underground film star and was in Underground USA, The Long Island Four, and she was very famously in Wild Style. She was involved in the early hip-hop graffiti culture of the late 70s or early 80s in New York. And she started the Fun Gallery, which showed Kenny Scharf and Keith Haring and Basquiat and a whole raft of graffiti artists like Rammel Z and Dondi and Lady Pink and Crash. So Patty, this is Patty on the cover of Mary Paul's book. I know this is a podcast. No one can see the book. It's a glamorous picture of her, I imagine, on the Staten Island Ferry with the World Trade Center behind her. It's a super fab Polaroid. She was blonde and a very unlikely person to be involved in the hip hop graffiti culture in New York City. And she was in it sort of by accident. She was, as I said, she was an underground film star, and she had some graffiti artists do a show in her apartment. And Bill Stelling had gone to the show and said, I have the space over on 11th Street. It's like $125 a month. Let's do a show. So she was married to this artist named Stephen Kramer. Stephen did a show. Kenny Scharf did one of the first shows. And originally the gallery was supposed to have a different name every time that had a different artist. But when Kenny did his show, it was called Fun. And that name just stuck.
Oh.
Keith did a show there early on too.
Was she related to Brooke Astor? I'm like,
that was my question.
Not at all. No. Her actual name is not Astor. I would look at her Wikipedia right now and tell you what it is, but everybody knows her as Patty Astor. Patty with an I.
I think that was sort of a joke at the time. She's sort of like, you know.
Well, like Perez Hilton sort of thing.
There you go.
Yeah. Joseph Astor, a well-known photographer, was also not an Astor.
And the DuPont twins were not DuPonts either. So exactly. It was sort of a joke at the time.
when I first moved to New York, I went to go see Underground USA. It was showing at the St. Mark's Cinema. And
Patricia Titchener, by the way, is her name.
That is her name, yes. So I went to go see Underground USA, and she was in it with Rene Ricard. It's Eric Mitchell's film. And about a few months later, I was staying in a sublet, and I was doing my laundry on Second Avenue. And there was Patty Astor in capri pants and flats doing her laundry. And I felt like I was doing my laundry with Marilyn Monroe or something. I was so that here was this glamour puss, like, you know, bopping around the laundromat.
So what has Patty been doing in the last decades or so? I haven't heard anything of her.
So she wrote a book of the true story of the Fun Gallery. She was back in New York City when MoMA did the big Club 57 show. She has done a lot of stuff with Wild Style for whatever the anniversary of that was, and probably the 40th anniversary of Wild Style. She was involved in that. And she was living in Hermosa Beach.
We could have seen her. Oh, dear.
And she was just one of those people like Diane Brill. She just was glamorous and fun and just as nice as can be. And everybody completely loved her. So it was a huge shock when everybody, you know, discovered that she wasn't with us anymore. This is a picture of her, which I'll talk about this book later. But this is, sorry, here. At a point.
Well, rest in power. Definitely. Patty Astor, one of our greats.
Did you know her, James?
I met her a few times, and like you said, Trey, you always felt you were in the presence of absolute royalty. She was somebody who had made quite an impression on you when you talked to her.
Yeah, blonde and pretty and fun and just always kind of the life of the party, and everybody gravitated towards her. And the Fun Gallery, what she did with the Fun Gallery was really monumental, and it led to you know, Basquiat's career. She talked a lot about Basquiat, and she was really supportive of artists and really against the commercial nature of art. So she wasn't really happy with the Basquiat doormats that are being made now.
Oh, right. Okay. Rest in Perfection, Patty Asta.
Number 8.
It is the new movie on Netflix that is a recreation of the BBC Newsnight interview that Prince Andrew Gray gave about his relationship with Epstein.
Ooh.
And it's so odd. I mean, because, like, I remember the interview and the fallout after the interview that led to him stepping back from public life. But it hardly seemed like something to make a whole movie about. You know, it's not Nixon versus Frost. It's not Best of Enemies, Gore Vidal and Bugsy. It's a weirdly sort of low-key thing. It just seems very odd.
How did they stretch it out into 2.5 hours or...
Well, it was under 100 minutes, so that was a good thing. And the guy Rufus Sewell plays Prince Andrew and is pretty good at being sort of boorish and crass and sort of jolly in all the wrong ways.
No, it's funny because I always thought that Rufus Sewell was so good looking in his younger years. Is he still? Does he hold up? Because Prince Andrew did not.
He kind of looks like Prince Andrew in this, but I think I've heard it was hours and hours of makeup. I tell you who is really good in it is Gillian Anderson. Remember? The
Always fantastic. She is just one of our greatest. She's on Meryl Streep and we don't even know
you're
that.
You're right. She plays the British reporter who did the interview, which I think is a very difficult role to play because all the interviewer does is really sit down and ask some questions. I mean, it is a brilliant sort of mimicry or recree of the interview. But
does it have a point of view and you walk away knowing that he's...
The point of view the film wants us to walk away having is, thank goodness for the BBC doing public service broadcasting in this era of cuts and cutbacks and consolidation, and that thanks to them, real stories and truth get spoken to power. That's the intention. I don't want to get cancelled, but I was watching the interview and thinking...
Especially when you have a book to promote.
I think this isn't that bad, the interview. And what the fallout, it was the tone deafness of the interview that was the real problem. And so the film depends on its sense of vengeance for the sort of social media outcry afterwards, which sort of just looks like getting cancelled. It's a weird... I don't.
Well, it's like a murder mystery, and you know who did it in the beginning.
Yes, exactly.
We know how this turns out.
You do, and it's sort of all somehow much less overwhelming than it felt like at the time. It's just I thought it was just very odd, but I did keep watching it. And Billy Piper plays Sam McAllister, who is the researcher, reporter, producer who gets the interview. But I couldn't tell you how she got the interview. It didn't seem very interesting, you know, and it didn't even feel like as good as an episode of The Crown. I was just really mystified by the whole thing.
I want to, just listening to you describe this, I want to introduce a new genre, clickbait documentaries. There have been so many scandals that happen day after day, hour after hour, that they just wash by us. They don't make the impact like the OJ trial did. And so, you know, they go by. So now you can just take 10 minutes of scandal, make an hour and a half documentary about it, just because we haven't thought about it in a long time. So it's a clickbait documentary.
Thank you. And it's a clickbait feature. But the thing is, it's like...
Feature.
There are so many egregious scandals. And I mean, how many terrible, horrible interviews has Trump given? Where's the movie about that? It's so
better than the movie. He's better than the movie. It's that idea of Netflix. Like, what's going to make you click? What's going to make you click? That's the clickbait. Yeah. And you're right. It is a clickbait featurette. It's like the movie of the week, but made even
right.
Exactly. Lighter. I think Ryan Murphy has possibly specialized in that whole idea. How to take Le Coq Basque and turn it into 6 episodes.
Oh, don't get it started.
Well, let's take a quick break. Hey, Tom, have we reached the finale of season 16?
Tonight, I'm glad you asked. which happens to be my birthday. Tonight is the reunion of Drag Race. We're 1 week away from the grand finale, but all of the queens who have been eliminated return for a lip sync smackdown for nine lip syncs, one winner, $50,000, and she will be the queen of She Done Already and Had Hers. The competition has just begun.
Right. It's an awesome season. And of course, where can you see it? MTV, yes. And WOW Presents Plus worldwide. Okay. Sign up at WOWPresentsPlus.com. Oh, Blake, have you got a question?
I do. Why does Michelin, a tire company, review restaurants?
I didn't realize it was the same Michelin's. I'll be damned.
Right. We'll have the answer right after the break here on the WOW Report.
You're listening to World of Wonders WOW Report. Things that make us go wow.
Welcome back to the WOW Report. It's Fenton here with Tom and James, our very special guest, Trey, and Blake, with the answer to a teasing question.
Yes, sir. I asked, why does Michelin, the tire company, review restaurants?
I want to take a stab. I have no idea. I think it's because they wanted to encourage... I take Michelin guides to go around Europe. They wanted to encourage...
Can I ask you not to say stab when we're talking about tires?
I thought it was going to be an OJ joke. Thank you for saving that. I'm going to say that they wanted to encourage travel and to let people know of restaurants around so they would get on their tires and wear them out and have you go to different parts of the country.
Was thinking it was because the tire guy liked to eat at a bunch of different restaurants.
Well, and that's why he was so fat.
I just learned this myself. I never put those two things together, Michelin tires and the Michelin star review. And it's because of they want you to wear out your tires driving around to different restaurants.
You have to think that there are 1,000 Michelins probably in the world, or maybe more. So it's what a coincidence.
I'm feeling very tired.
Ba-dum-bum.
All right, we're counting down the top 10 things. We've reached number 7.
Number 7.
I want us to party right here like it's 1864. Why? Now, I know you don't usually come to the WOW Report for your reports on female health and rights, but, you know, things that make you go, wow, this week, you know, we know the ex-president, the one who will not be named, went on, created some stupid, unsavory, illogical thing about how states' rights should decide abortion rights. And as if scripted, Arizona upheld a law from an abortion ban from 1864. Now, you know, I talked to some of my college friends or, you know, like, you know, about, you know, progressive and conservatives, like, and I'm like, I can't be a Republican because they want to push us back to 1864. What do you need to know how crazy the world has gotten? So I had to do a little research, and this is where I started off. In 1864, there was a thing called the American Civil War going on. I don't know if you guys have heard of it, but that was still happening, 1864. Abraham Lincoln had just been reelected in a landslide. Nevada was admitted as the 36th United States, U.S. state. Arizona, by the way, did not become a state until 1912. So we're talking about territory craziness. And Queen Victoria is in the middle of her reign. She was the queen from 1837 to 1901. It's just bonkers. So then I went on to sort of read, and this was news to me because I grew up Catholic. So I find talking about abortion uncomfortable, just being honest. I'm not saying it's a good thing to do, but it's like, because it was drilled in me that it was a terrible thing, that it's awful. It's, you know, they all the baby fetishism and the idea that we love little unborn life so much, but then we refuse to, like, you know, actually feed it and take care of it. Mm-hmm. But they said once America was established, for years and years and years, abortion was accepted. It was more a shame that someone might be single and had sex was a shame, but having abortions happen, and it was up until a point of quickening because they didn't have ultrasounds and stuff. So it was like kind of third trimester where they could tell if the baby was moving, and they used to ingest herbs or cause infections, horrible kind of barbaric things, but they did that. And they were mostly performed by midwives, women taking care of women. And it was not until the 1840s when the tide started to turn. A couple of things happened. There were a couple of high profile trials where women had sought abortions and become very ill or died. And also it was the creation of the American Medical Association, a bunch of white guys in 1847 who wanted to get the midwives out of there. You know what I'm saying? And there were also cultural things in place because, you know, these white men thought that women needed to be home having babies. And there was a racial context because it was the idea which you share today, which is they want the wrong people were having babies, that white women were having abortions when they needed to have them, and that people who were not white were having babies. And so the world was going to be filled with brown and black babies. So I don't know. It's just, it made me dig a little bit deeper and you realize the context of the time of 1864 and why we are putting women's lives at risk for such craziness. I don't know. And I know we all agree. I just couldn't let that one slip by this week.
And did I miss it? But did you say when they passed this law, they weren't even part of the United States? So
they were a territory or something, you know,
Maine.
It wasn't even a state. It was a territory. You know, that's how it worked back then. Like we hope DC is a territory and they can turn DC into a state. So we'd have some balance.
I don't understand how that stays on the books for 160 years. And they can refer back to it when it seems so archaic.
Oh, it absolutely is. The dusting it off, looking who, what Republican person looked, you know, crazy Republican person. They're all crazy. If you, whenever, but was so happy when they unearthed this, like, you know, from the.
Mary Lake talked about it. She talked about it on, you know, a couple of years ago. She was on a panel talking about, we still have this law on the books. You know, now she's trying to back away from it because the Republicans are going to really find themselves, you know, in a tough situation because this is going to be on the ballot in November, yeah, along with the presidential election. So,
and I was hearing commentary on The View and on the NPR in the morning, the boringest news outlet, but how abortion may not be the pivot, the you know, prior to this, how abortion may not be the issue that pushes people to the polls. Uh-huh. I have to think this makes it pretty visceral.
Yeah.
You know, anyway.
So yeah, half the country has those bad abortion bans on the books. 25 states or something have some weird abortion ban.
Women's health, so women helping women, help women, please. Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on to number six. Trey.
Number six.
There is a pyramid pioneer palooza happening. For those of you who don't know that much about the early 80s in New York City, there was a club called the Pyramid Cocktail Lounge, not the Pyramid Club. And it was an incubator for all sorts of tomfoolery, lots of drag. When Rue first came to New York, it was one of the first places he landed with Lady Bunny and the Now Explosion. I lived across the park. Fenton, you lived very nearby as well at that time. And Brian Butterick was one of the early pyramid pioneers. He worked at the club. And he and Susan Martin, who did PR for the club, and Kostutis Nakas, who was a performer at the pyramid, wrote this book called We Started a Nightclub. And it's the whole history of the club told by the people who were there. So it's got like 75 interviews. That book is coming out next week. And along with it, there's an exhibit at Howl Arts, which is at 250 Bowery. And Howl has had a lot of great exhibits. They had a show in 2015. Brian Butterick was very involved with Howl. Brian passed away a few years ago. But Susan and Kostutis really carried this on. I'm working with the a fabulous curator there called Aldo Hernandez, and Jane Friedman, who's been running Howl Art. So I combed through my archives, found all sorts of posters and memorabilia and photographs. I used to do a show there called Straight to Hell. So I dug up a lot of those things. Actually, the fabulous Pop-Tarts performed for Straight to Hell at the Pyramid, which, if you don't know, Fenton Daly was one half of the fabulous Pop-Tarts. So that exhibit is next week on the 18th of April. And, oh, there we go. There's the fabulous
Pop. Oh, good God.
Who was the fabulous half of the fabulous Pop?
There's a fabulous Pop.
Oh, my God. T-shirt. You have that T-shirt right there.
You know, I have it right here. That's part of the show, too.
Well, of course, Trey designed the logo. But
yes, I did. I designed the logo, and we did. Here's another one. This is Happy Face. I'm happy you're gay. so that show is on the 18th, and then on the 20th, there's a big performance at a place called Baker Falls, which is in the former Pyramid Space.
The Pop-Tarts will be performing?
Yes, the Pop-Tarts are being flown in on private jet. No, but Anne Magnuson's coming to town.
I like her, but she's no fabulous Pop-Tarts. I'm sorry.
No fabulous Pop-Tarts. I think I messaged you, Fenton, saying you should come to town.
Good. Of course. And also recently, I mean, not to be clickbaity about it, but I think it was in the basement of the Pyramid that Madonna and Rue had their fateful encounter that's written up in the House of Hidden Meanings. So,
yes, I think that, yes. And that was, and actually Rue talked about it. I think he did an Instagram post talking about the early days at the Pyramid recently, you know, brought back, I guess, by his memoir. Simultaneously, I have a new book. My first book was called 80s Polaroids, and the new volume is called More 80s Polaroids. And that has
about?
A lot
What's
of
the book about? What's the book about?
It's about it's all pyramid, people. It's all
good
it's,
for you.
They're Instamatic photographs. Nice. There's Keith here. You guys probably have copies of this book. Yeah. So the new volume has Constance Cooper on the cover, volume 2. That'll be available. There's a lot of pyramid people in that book. And you can get that at TreySpiegel.com. You can find out about the Howl Show at HowlArts.org. You can find out about the book, which is called We Started a Nightclub, at SomeSeriousBusiness.org.
I'm excited to see that book, too, I must say. So it's sort of pyramid palooza, is what we're saying.
It had everything you never wanted to know about the pyramid.
And more.
And more. There's photographs. Lynn Grabowski has pictures in the book and also in the exhibit. Jody Carrilla has dug through her archives. And it's going to be, you know, Dinosaur Club Week next week at in New York City. A lot of people are coming in for it. You saw that, I think you posted the clip that Diane Brill was just in town and had her birthday party. Your birthday is when, Tom? Today?
Well, Friday. Yeah, today.
Today. Mine is the next day, the 13th.
So it's birthdays, it's pyramid, and it's the 80s again.
It's the
1864, but 1980 as well. And we're all 80 years old. So it's a theme. Well. I'm just trying to get things to smile. It's so hard today. All right, let's move on. Okay. Number five. The end of last month, March 28th, there was a screening at 10 a.m. at the Universal City Walk, at the IMAX Universal City Walk. And it was the unveiling for a VIP audience only of Francis Ford Coppola's new movie, Megalopolis.
Yes.
I was not invited. I didn't. But everybody else was there. And this was supposed to be a moment at which, you know, he's been an amazing, Tom's probably going to talk about him on a little later in the show, but he's an amazing, iconic director who has also gone bankrupt a few times. But recently sold his wine business, which is much admired, and used some of the money from that sale to fund a $120 million movie that he's wanted to make all his life. And apparently it tells the story of Megalopolis, the city that is accidentally destroyed. And the movie is about two dueling architects rebuilding. On the one hand, it's Adam Driver playing the idealist architect, and Giancarlo Esposito plays the pragmatist mayor, and they're just sort of battling it out with these two they're not two architects, one's a mayor, one's an architect, but they've got conflicting visions of how to rebuild Megalopolis. So they had this big screening, every head of the industry, you know, because I think the idea was that he would land a deal from this screening. Everyone would just fall about, oh, it's so marvelous. Well, the Hollywood Reporter writes that there was, and this is perhaps the worst thing to happen that can happen to you, a conspicuous silence at the end of it. And then there's some sort of anonymous comments, like some kind of indie experiment, someone said. Someone said, everyone is rooting for Francis and feels nostalgic, but... And apparently there's a cringy, I'm quoting here, a cringy sequence involving John Voight's character in bed with what looks like a huge erection. The scene evidently takes quite the turn, but we're not going to spoil it here. So who knows what that's about? I don't know. A megalopolis.
It's so interesting you're saying this. I was at Radio City Music Hall in 1981, 82, when One from the Heart premiered.
I love that movie.
Radio City. And it starts
Don't
out...
Don't Give Pujold, right?
No. It's Terry Garr and Frederick Forrest. And it's set in Las Vegas. It's a love story set in Las Vegas on the 4th of July. And it's visually really amazing. Kinski is in it.
Natasha Kinski.
And so this movie has incredible visuals. It was Zoetrope Studios. Coppola banked in the same way as he is on Megalopolis on One from the Heart being this revolutionary kind of film. It's visually really amazing. The same thing happened. The movie ended and I was sitting like right near the front. And in the wings, I could see Coppola. And that was the beginning of the end of Zoetrope Studios. The movie bombed and it bankrupted Zoetrope and it bankrupted Coppola. And he was, until for years, he was kind of just a director for hire. And so this Megalopolis is kind of his way back, but it sounds like the same thing happened again.
Just God bless him for investing in his own ideas, though.
Why not? He's 80, whatever. I mean, you know, why not roll the dice? Like,
you said, One from the Heart. Hasn't it then been revisionist thinking about that movie?
Yes. It's when Blade Runner came out, which was Ridley Scott, it was a disaster, right? And One from the Heart has become a beloved classic, you know? So
it's an incredible movie. And visually, the way it starts out is just incredible. There was the red curtain in Radio City with the spotlight on the curtain and the curtain opens and that turns into the moon. And then you travel down through the moon, through the clouds, and you come to every marquee in Las Vegas and they show all of the characters' names, all the marquees, and then you go up and over and into the first scene, one shot, the whole thing from the moon all the way down.
You're making me want to watch it. Fenton, would you ever go see Megalopolis now?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm going to go with James when there's a screening.
I want to come with you.
Right. Awesome. Well, good luck to Francis Ford Coppola, right? I agree with you, Tom. Like, put the money where the mouth is. And, you know, he's a genius filmmaker. So let's take a break. RuPaul's DragCon LA 2024 tickets are on sale. That's on July 19th and 20th at the Los Angeles Convention Center. Just announced the Global Glamazon Show, which is after hours at DragCon. Marina Summers, Organza, Pandora Knox, La Grande Dame, many, many more. So that's July 19th and 20th at the LA Convention Center. Hey, Blake, where do you get the tickets?
RuPaulsDragCon.com, of course.
Of course. You got a question?
I do. What recently divorced starlet, descended from Hollywood royalty, recently admitted she can't poop or pee alone?
Natasha Kinski. Geneviève Bujold.
Well, they have the answer right after the
break. Francis Ford Coppola.
You're listening to World of Wonders WOW Report. Things that make us go wow.
Welcome back to the WOW Report. I'm Fenton here with Tom and James and Trey and, of course, Blake.
Yep, and I asked, what recently divorced starlet descended from Hollywood royalty recently admitted she can't poop or pee alone?
Why?
I'm going to say Jamie Lee Curtis.
I'm going to say Dakota Johnson.
No.
I'm completely
wrong. Drew Barrymore.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, probably. Why? Who poops with her? I don't understand the question. Why is she bringing
it's our very own Tori Spelling, of course.
Oh, because she had so many kids or something?
She said on her podcast that someone asked her recently, or someone told her recently that she
asked her if she can poop alone? How does this even, where does this even come up?
Someone told her recently she should just be single and be happy. And she was like, I'm never alone. I've never even pooped or peed alone for 18 years with Dean. And now the kids sit in there and watch me while I poop and pee.
Dean used to watch her poop?
Listen to Misspellings wherever you podcast.
All right.
Is your podcast called Too Much Information?
This is the strangest question. I don't quite know what to do next. Should we just carry on with the countdown?
Number four.
And speaking of Tori Spelling and her dad, have you heard about the Melrose Place reboot?
I just did. Just the headline. I just read the headline. I don't read the article.
Yeah,
we're learning over and over and over again in this podcast that that's all anyone does.
Well, it is in development at CBS Studios and is currently being shot to networks and streamers. Deadline has reported.
Haven't they tried to reboot Melrose Place? Like,
this should be the second reboot.
Is a reboot, but what makes this
is this a reboot of the reboot or just the first one?
What makes this one different is Locklear, Laura Layton, and Daphne Zuniga are all attached to replay their characters again.
And Lisa Rinna, of course, will be in it.
I hope so. Her hair at least has to make an cameo.
I would like to coin a phrase. Toot or retoot? Boot or reboot? What is it called?
Tori Spelling would say poop or reboot.
Yeah, I think this ignores the early aughts reboot, maybe, or I don't know. It says that in the new installment, when one of their dearest friends dies suddenly, the OG residents of Melrose Place gather to honor the deceased, but the pressure cooker of reunion soon uncovers old traumas, rekindles old romances, reignites old resentments, and reveals new secrets.
Sounds like every episode of the WoW Report.
Yeah, it does. Throwing our characters into chaotic drama that's reminiscent of the past, but with a much more modern perspective.
Listen, if this is an opportunity to be over the top and campy, I'm all for it. You know, it has to be campy or I don't even know what happened. So I hope it's this over the top, crazy. I'll never forget the Melrose Place ad with the year. Because Heather Locklear came on like Joan Collins on Dynasty. She came on the second season. They had to introduce a villain. And the posters everywhere was just a real extreme close-up of her face. And it said, because they were moving it to Mondays, and it was like, Mondays are a bitch. And it was Heather Locklear. Oh, there's never been better advertising before or after.
Well, and then we ripped it off, didn't we?
We did. Mondays are a drag, RuPaul. Thank you for revealing all my sources.
Yes. Well, you just revealed it. Well, Heather Locklear is like, she always comes in to save a show, right? Didn't she do the same with Spin City?
Yes, she did.
She's the Ted McGinley of a female.
But actor. I thought she was like going through some rough times. I guess this means she's on the mend, which is great.
Good to hear.
We love her.
Well, I also want to tell you about, you probably didn't hear about this, the most LA car wreck crash ever. On this week, there was a 3-car Tesla pileup at Rexford and Beverly. And
Benton, do you have anything you need to tell us?
There was not a blue Model S. There was an X, a Y, and a 3 Series, and they were all different colors. And it was at Rexford and Beverly, which I think is a pretty rough intersection there in Beverly Hills. But
it's very rough at Rexford and Beverly in Beverly Hills. Oh my gosh.
Well, I don't mean rough and crime.
I know.
There's like that one place where there's like cars coming in every direction.
Why did they pile up? Were they all on autopilot or what?
Well, that's what I thought. I thought that the Teslas would like slam on the brakes and not allow you to run into
everyone. Was napping.
Yeah. Jeff
used to have an aesthetician at Beverly.
They were all on their phones.
Yeah. Jeff Beecher, the mega producer, one of the Teslas was actually his, but he wasn't driving. It was his assistant.
Always the assistant. Always blame the assistant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's all I've got for Hot Topics this week.
Hot.
Thank you, Blake, for that scintillating Hot Topics. We're moving up now to number three, Tom.
Number three.
Now, speaking of being old homosexuals, you know how we can tend to shame...
Is that what we were talking about?
I didn't know. I feel like when I look at the screen, it's the first thing that pops to my mind. I have to keep myself from shaming people who don't have the same
start. What hell of a start we got there.
I have to remind myself not to shame younger people who don't have the same pop culture references that we do. You know, they'll get a lot of them along the way. I like to think that I impart some of them onto people, because I have a confession to make as a very young person here on the call, is until this week, I had never seen The Godfather. That came out in 1970. I know. And I had no idea you're going to talk about Francis Ford Coppola. And it was on Turner Classic Movies, which is the young people's network, right, James? Because I always catch it in the middle. I was too young to go to the theater to see it. I do remember it because it was a pop culture phenomenon in every Mike Douglas or every Merv Griffin. It's a movie full of memes. I know that's not the way it was at the time. But like, you know, everything is going to come out of their mouths before it comes out of their mouths. And it
will to me at my daughter's wedding.
Yes. Leave the gun, take the cannoli. My parents went to very few movies as adults. Like, they just were busy, like, raising kids and whatever. And they went to see The Godfather and thought it was tremendous. And it took me a minute to get into it. I'm in my Turner Classic Move. I'm Googling. I'm reading ahead. And I got to tell you, if you guys don't know, if you guys haven't seen it, it's a
headline here, Godfather is good. Is
this what the
takeaway is?
Not that I was surprised.
Hold on, Godfather 1.
Just Godfather 1. I have now DVR 2 and DVR'd the version of Godfather 3 that was Francis Ford Coppola's re-edit, the director's cut, which I'll be looking at later this week. So we can talk about this for weeks to come. But what threw me, I've never seen Al Pacino so young and handsome.
Oh. Well, that he was on a roll right there with Dog Day Afternoon, Panicking in Needle Park. All of those were so handsome.
And he's so handsome. And there was times when they went to Sicily or whatever and he was hiding out. I was like, is that? I couldn't even tell if that was really him. I had to go back to the Wikipedia. And something else, maybe the most important takeaway I have, and this is shaming, so I have a lot of work to do, but Diane Keaton's had a nose job. A very young Diane Keaton is in it. And she has a really bulbous nose, which I don't remember ever seeing since, but she's so good in it. She has I didn't realize she was the last person you see in the movie because he's getting his ring kissed, Al Pacino, and he's just lied to her and says that he didn't murder his brother-in-law, and she's like catches him as he's having his rings kissed by his subordinates. I mean, it's so beautiful. And the other amazing thing, I believe it was produced in 61 days.
Wow. If you liked part one, you're going to just be blown away by part two.
And, you know, I don't read, so all I have are bad television references, but it's totally different from, but, like, it seduced me like Succession. You know, it's just like every character, every scene, every actor. And it was so lush and beautiful. I love the cars, like when there's Vito's funeral, the cars, these 50s cars with big things of flowers in the back. It was just so Italian and authentic.
The wedding in the beginning, you feel like you're in that wedding for half an hour. That wedding goes on and on and on, and you really feel like you get the culture just from that wedding. You know immediately who everybody is. It's the whole thing is super delicious.
So what's considered to be the best and most influential movie of all time, I finally saw only, 52 years later. Good for me.
But it goes to show that a great filmmaker will make films that will last the test of time, even if in the moment, although that in the moment was a huge success, wasn't it? It was like out of the box hit and has been much beloved ever since. But he's had such a roller coaster, amazing career. And it's such an amazing...
I'll also say that I became aware of Marlon Brando during like Last Tango in Paris. Like he was just this freaky guy. And he's kind of freaky in this. And so he's there and then he gets shot. He kind of goes away and then he comes back. But I get it. I get the Marlon Brando. I mean, I've seen him on the waterfront and all that kind of stuff. But like he's, again, a magical performer as well. So Godfather, here we go.
All right. Number two.
Number two.
Okay, so I talked about something that was unwatchable, which was Scoop. It wasn't really unwatchable. And something that might be undistributable, which is Francis Ford Coppola's latest film. This is unmakeable. Okay, it's White Horse. This is a series that has not been made and never will be made, even though Netflix have spent and lost $51 million in the not making of it. I'm going to tell you the story. And I owe this story to the New York Times, an article that in November 23 last year came out. The algorithm only just surfaced it in my feed recently. And I started reading it and I was fascinated because we've worked with Netflix and occasionally we've argued about overages of like $400. And so I'm wondering, how do you spend $51 million? You know, how does that work?
$400 at a time, Fenton, $400 at a time.
Here's what happened. Carl Rynch, have you ever heard of Carl Rynch? Uh-huh. He directed a movie. He's directed one movie. I mean, that was also, I was like, what? He's directed one movie, 47 Ronin. Have you heard of 47 Ronin? Starred Keanu Reeves, came out Christmas Day 2013. Giant bomb. It cost $175 million and it lost almost every penny. So that was Carl Rynch's directorial debut. And until Netflix swooped in and gave him $51 million to make a new series, that was all he'd ever done. And the story is supposedly of a series about a human-like species that were invented by a genius, and they're called organic intelligence. And he and Carl and his wife came up with this idea. She was a producer and a costume designer as well. And they sold it in 2018, which is referred to as the streaming boom. So this is, you know, when you've got 500 scripted series.
Spend.
Yes. And he was going to do the deal with Amazon. And on Sunday night, Netflix swooped in, offered him Final Cut, locked him and his wife to every spin-off for life, and handed him $51 million. Well, it didn't turn out very well. They did some filming in Brazil, and he made everybody work for 24 hours without sleeping. He said he had autism and attention deficit hyperactivity, and that the medications made him go a little off kilter. He accused his wife of plotting to have him assassinated. He took the budget, he put it in a Charles Schwab account, lost all the money. Then he took more money and put it into crypto and made $27 million in Dogecoin profits. And then he went and bought 5 Rolls Royces, a Ferrari, a watch.
That's the series.
Exactly.
Making of.
Netflix need to make lemonade out of their lemons, right?
That's a more interesting talk about the documentary, you know, clickbait. I want to watch that.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
It does sound kind of good. Unfortunately, they're still locked in litigation. So just how it's all going to end, no one knows, except it's never going to get made. But yeah, sounds kind of a juicy story. One last break, and then we'll come back and reveal the number one thing this week that made us go, wow.
You're listening to World of Wonders Wow Report. Things that make us go wow.
Welcome back to the Wow Report. Fenton here with Blake and James and Tom and our very special guest, Trey. Blake, I think you're doing the number one this week.
Number one.
Did you guys see the eclipse?
I saw it online.
Did any of you?
I watched the 47 hours of coverage on ABC News where they could just kept saying over and over, there's an eclipse. And that was, they had to preempt General Hospital to watch what was going on.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry.
I saw the headline, but I didn't read the article.
Well, I actually flew home to Arkansas because Arkansas is in the path of totality.
Right.
So it was amazing. I've seen normal eclipses where, you know, you have the goggles and you look at the moon and or you look at the sun with the moon passing over it. And
is this different than the moon passing by the sun?
Well, this was just like this until it wasn't. All of a sudden, we were in totality and you could look at the sun and see the most amazing ring of light, like. You could look at it.
Wait, you actually, you looked at the eclipse as it was happening?
They tell you not to look at the eclipse as it's happening, but once you reach totality, you can look up and see the moon in front of the sun with the ring of light around it, and everything turns to like dusk. So it looks like it's, you know,
darkness.
Yeah. And then it slowly starts rising again. It's like the sun rising again. It was really, really cool.
You had a big, were you at a big outdoor event type thing where there was a million people?
No, I was actually on, I got together with my family on at the old farm off of Amity Road in Hot Springs. And the day had already started weird because as we were gathering to watch the eclipse, my mom and sister and niece, they went to check their bunnies that Opal had gotten for Christmas. She named them Rita and Janet after these Bluey characters. Well, it turns out that Rita has a penis and he's been giving it to Janet. So now they have like 10 bunnies.
This week on the Waltons.
Mm-hmm. So they're eclipse bunnies.
How long does the, when you're in the zone of totality, is that right? How long does that last? How long can you look up at the?
It was like 4 minutes was like the whole totality of it.
I still don't see why this is such a huge international story that we've been talking about for a month now.
James, with all due respect, if you ever left your place during the day, you would be shocked that it actually turns from, it goes from light to dark.
So what you're saying is it goes from like, from being sunny to a cloud going over the sun.
No, it goes to be nighttime.
Someone's in a mood today.
We pushed James too hard today. We rely on him for humor because he, you know, he is the star of the show. Well, one too many times and now he's dry.
James, it sounds like you don't believe Blake that he had an a transcendental experience.
It's no scandal about Kate Middleton or anything, but
how much did you spend to see the sun go under the moon?
Money is only an. How much did you spend on Oscar de la Renta brooches?
It's on. Thank you, Trey. Thank you, Blake. Thank you, James. And thank you, Tom. And thank you, everyone, for listening to this week's WOW Report. Same time, same place next week. Until then, go out and do something that makes the world go wow.